My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
And welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and I'd like to thank anyone who's tuning in today and anyone who tuned in last time for my interview with Blaze Bailey about Dio's phenomenal debut album, Holy Diver. And it was nice to do an album from the 80s. You know, a bit of love for the 80s, because I looked back on the albums that we'd done in the previous 20 episodes of My Classic Album that kind of form season one, if you like. And they were predominantly from the 70s. You know, if there was a pie chart, the 70s were well represented in some of the other decades, particularly the 80s and the 60s, I think, where could maybe you're done with a little more love. So it was nice, you know, when all that amazing music has come out in the 80s, it was nice to kind of visit some of that. And it's interesting that this week I've been talking with a lot of people, potential guests for the podcast in the future, and a lot of them are picking albums from the 80s, including my guest today, punk singer Louise DeStrass, who has chosen the debut album from Nirvana, Bleach, which was released in 1989. And yeah, it's a really interesting album because it's there just as grunge is about to explode. You know, that it's been heavy metal, the likes of Dio, you know, and then as we got into the late 80s, the likes of Def Leppard and Bon Jovi and Poison and Motley Crue were kind of ruling the airwaves. But these are the sort of bands that we're talking about that were just huge at that time. But meanwhile, in Seattle, there was all this other stuff going on. And this is kind of, for a lot of people, Bleach was perhaps the introduction to that. But Louise is coming up in just a little bit, and we'll get into all that. We'll get into the mind frame of Kurt Cobain. It, you know, really interesting chat. Really looking forward to you guys hearing it. I'm just generally excited for all the stuff that's coming up over the next few weeks for you to listen to. There's some awesome guests and brilliant albums still to come. To keep up to date on upcoming episodes, upcoming guests, all that kind of thing. Plenty of ways to do it. Get yourself to www.myclassicalbum.co.uk, and we've got links to all of our social media channels. Our Facebook page, search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page. That's usually the first port of call for any kind of news related to the podcast. Follow us on Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast, or follow us on Twitter at @MCA_podcast. And don't forget that all of our previous episodes, including the likes of Blaze Bailey, Dizzy Reed, Big Boy Bloater, and Rob Wild's previous episode, dedicated to Hysteria, are all available on Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. And there's some great ones to listen back to there, so absolutely feel free to check them out. But before you do that, there is the matter of today's episode to be getting on with. So my special guest today is Louise DeStrass, and she has chosen the debut album by Nirvana, Bleach. But before we get to Louise and we find out why she's chosen that album and a bit more about it, here are some of the facts. This is the beginning of what you need to know about Bleach. American grunge band Nirvana's debut album Bleach was released on the 15th of June 1989 by Seattle-based record label Sub Pop. The album was recorded at Reciprocal Recording Studios in Seattle after Sub Pop requested an EP from the band, who in turn decided to produce a full-length album instead, with local producer Jack Endino. Bleach was recorded over several sessions throughout December 1988 and January 1989, the product of which was combined with three songs recorded earlier the previous year to create the finished album. Nirvana's debut single Love Buzz was actually released before the Bleach sessions began, A slightly different mix of the song would make the final album. Only 1,000 copies of the single were said to be made, although some claim an additional 200 copies were also pressed. An EP with opening track Blue was also released in December 1989. However, this was only in the UK, and only 3,000 copies were made, making the Blue EP highly collectible amongst fans. Upon its release in June 1989, Bleach, while well received, critically failed to make any kind of noise in the charts. However, following the success of their second album Nevermind in 1991, Geffen Records reissued Bleach internationally the following year. This time, Bleach reached number 89 on the Billboard 200 and number 33 on the UK album charts. Sales of the album over the years have helped it achieve platinum status on both sides of the Atlantic, the 1.9 million copies sold in America sealing Bleach as Sub Pop's best-selling release. Bleach was critically praised, and over time its importance to the rise of grunge has been heavily cited. GQ magazine called Bleach the 11th coolest album in the world right now. In 2005, Classic Rock magazine named it amongst its 150 greatest debut albums ever in 2006, and NME placed Bleach as number 460 in its 500 greatest albums of all time in 2013. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Bleach, and I have here with me my special guest today who chose the album. This is Louise Distress. How's it going?
Hello, I'm doing all right, thanks. Just sitting here with a nice cup of tea, Yorkshire tea, of course. Yeah, ready to be interrogated about my favourite classic album.
Brilliant. So, first of all, before we kind of get into the ins and outs of the album, why have you chosen Bleach specifically to talk about on my classic album today?
Because Bleach was the album that changed my life. And if it wasn't for that record, I wouldn't be here today talking to you.
What are those initial memories of hearing that album for the first time?
Well, how I actually first heard the album was because a friend of mine at school made me a mixtape, which had songs from Bleach by Nirvana on it. So from there, you know, I went and bought a copy from my local Woolworths because I actually didn't know anything about Nevermind. And what I guess appealed to the album was just remembering how bleak and sparse and how angry the album sounds. You know, it basically sounds like a bunch of misfits who've been signed off to destitution and onto the garbage heap of life, you know. So as an angry teenager who was bullied at home and bullied at school and who felt very isolated and very alone, that was the album that changed my life because it made me feel like I wasn't alone. It was my first introduction to punk rock, was my first introduction to the whole idea that there was actually another world out there that I could create for myself and express on my own terms, you know. So if it wasn't for that, I would have never even started playing guitar or discovered punk rock or even be around today.
Yeah. So this is the first Nirvana album we've actually covered on my classic album. By any stretch, they're an iconic band, and many have called Kurt Cobain the voice of a generation. And a lot of that high praise and esteem comes from Nevermind. And you were saying that when you first heard the tracks from Bleach that you'd not really heard Nevermind before. What is it about Bleach? Is it that sentimental value that makes it a more important album for you than Nevermind? Or is there other stuff going on there too?
Well, I love all the Nirvana albums. And like I said, the sentimental feeling about it is just because it was the first time that I ever heard something that sounded like how I felt inside. And I think it was also the case for many, many other young people around the world at that time and also today as well. It's just one of those albums that it just changes your life.
Yeah, so, I mean, as I've said, this is Nirvana's debut album, and Bleach stands as a document of the band as they were in the late 80s. At this time, Nirvana were a large part of the growing grunge scene in Seattle. So in the same way that punk became this alternative to kind of the glam and prog rock of the 70s, grunge became this kind of stark contrast to the hair metal bands that were dominating MTV at the time. How important is this album in building that foundation of grunge before it explodes in the 90s when the likes of Nevermind are released?
I'm someone who's just purely a music fan, you know. I'm not really interested in all the fluff and the ins and outs of the music press, because I usually just find that 9 out of 10 times, you know, the music press just get it wrong anyway. I think it's pretty simple, really, when you break it down, you know, down to the basics, that Nirvana were just a bunch of weirdos and misfits playing music in a garage just because they loved to play music and because they felt alone and you know, because music was an outlet for them, you know, just the same as it is for many people and the same as it is for me today, you know. So I think that, you know, I wasn't around at that time, so I couldn't possibly even give any kind of, you know, analysis or journalistic analysis about the album. All I know is how it made me feel and how it made other people feel, and, you know, and also how it still makes people feel today, and the legacy that the band and their music will have, hopefully, forever.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Bleach album came about as a result of a Seattle-based record label, Sub Pop, releasing Nirvana's debut single, Love Buzz, in late 1988, requesting an EP from the band, who in turn thought, well, let's just make them an album. So there's a very kind of DIY ethos to the album, which we'll kind of go into as we go on. But to give people an idea, the studio sessions for Bleach came to the sum of $606.17. Do you see it as kind of a DIY album to you? I mean, you've said before about kind of the sparseness of it in the anger. Is that something that you think that the other albums possibly lack?
I think that all bands are DIY bands. You know, I can't think of a band... Well, sorry, I'll rephrase that. Like, every band I know is a DIY band. Everybody writes their own songs and, you know, records their own music and has their own artistic vision. So I think that all bands are DIY, but if you want to really get into DIY, I think that phrase means something different to a lot of different people. I mean, what is interesting about Bleach, I actually recently found out that Kurt actually felt a lot of pressure from Sub Pop to actually conform to writing heavy, moody, grunge, rock and roll style music, because that was the aesthetic of Sub Pop label at the time. It was quite interesting to find out that he actually wrote most of the lyrics the night before those recording sessions, you know, when he was just feeling pissed off and under pressure. And I think that that's probably why the album does sound so angry and so bleak. But it's quite funny, you know, that as an artist, you know, you can write the songs and, you know, and not really see too much in the lyrics, you know, like Kurt said about the lyrics and Bleach, he didn't really take them very seriously. But, you know, once you release, as an artist, once you release a record and it doesn't belong to you anymore and it goes into the hearts and souls and ears of other people, you know, the way that they connect with it is completely different. So, you know, there's probably a bunch of throwaway lyrics in there that Kurt didn't really care for, but some of those lyrics, you know, mean absolutely the world to me. And I was able to identify with them as a lonely teenager, and they changed my life. So it's very, very interesting. You know, I don't really think there's a wrong or right answer. You know, music and records, you know, it just means a million different things to a million different people, and it can mean a million different things to the artist as well, you know, depending on what mood they're in at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a quote from Kurt here about the lyrics on Bleach. He said he didn't give a flying fuck what the lyrics were about on Bleach, and claimed that 80% of them, as you'd said, were written the night before recording. It was like, I'm pissed off, don't know what about, let's just scream negative lyrics, and as long as they're not sexist and don't get too embarrassing, it'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and what's interesting is there is almost kind of like a punk ethos to that that kind of translates through the album. And as you'd said, you know, for him they may have been throwaway, but to, you know, all the people who discovered Nirvana with this album, they certainly weren't throwaway to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of my favourite lyrics are actually from the song Paper Cuts. That was actually the first song that I learned to play on guitar as well.
So the album was produced by Jack Endino, and it was recorded at his Reciprocal recording studio. So in Michael Azarad's book, Come As You Are, he describes the studio itself. He says the paint peeled off the particle board walls. There were cigarette burns all over every horizontal surface. It didn't matter a bit if you spilled your beer on the carpet. Do you think that sometimes, from your own experience as well, that the surroundings and the conditions that you're recording in, that they can affect the final product?
Well, ultimately, it's all about energy, and making any record is all about capturing a vibe. So I think that it probably does have some kind of effect on your mindset, and that energy translates into the record. But saying that, you know, I recorded my new album in a really, really nice studio, but it didn't lose any of the feeling or of a vibe that actually was in the record. So I don't know, really. I guess it depends. It swings and roundabouts. You know, I record music in a lot of different ways. You know, I write and record demos on my sofa at home on my phone, but then sometimes I record them in a living room on Pro Tools. You know, I've recorded in nice studios, bad studios, but Yeah, it's every recording experience has been completely different. But I think what's really interesting is I love to hear about other artists' recording experiences. Like just yesterday, I was just having a conversation with somebody about Korn when they were recording one of their albums, and the producer was telling Jonathan Davis, you know, to go back to those memories of him being abused as a child, you know, so that he was able to, you know, tap into those feelings that he had then, you know, and then bring it out into the record. So sometimes it is a case of like changing your surroundings or almost going into method acting or revisiting those memories and feelings, you know, that inspired you to write the song, you know, in order to be able to bring out the vibe on the record. Yeah, there's a lot of different methods, I guess.
So one of the key differences between Bleach and Future Nirvana albums is the absence of Dave Grohl on drums. So Dave didn't even join the band until 1990. And it's Chad Channing behind the kit for the majority of this album. So, of course, no one was to know how the lineup would change at that time, of course. And no one would know the heights that Dave Grohl would reach with Foo Fighters long after Nirvana. Do you think that Nirvana's sound, how did it evolve, do you think, when Dave joined the band? Do you think that it would have changed in the same way had Chad stayed and stuck around?
Oh, you know, I'm just a music fan, you know, at the end of the day. I don't really think when people listen to records, I think that they just want to listen to a record and just enjoy it for what it is and think about the feeling that it gives them, you know. Some people do like to, you know, go into the what ifs and coulda, shoulda, wouldas and, you know, what might have happened, you know, with a band lineup and with a record. But I'm not really, you know, I'm not really into the technical side of things or, you know, facts and figures and things like that. You know, I just like listening to music because I just like music and the feeling that it gives me, really. So, you know, I don't really know what difference it would have made. And to be honest, I don't really care either way, you know. You know, ultimately, you know, like, for me, you know, a song's a song. And you know, I write a lot of my songs the same way that Kurt wrote his songs, which was basically, you know, just sitting down with an acoustic guitar, you know. So it's just chords, melody and a feeling at the end of the day. So a song is a song as far as I'm concerned. And I think that the proof in the pudding in that shows, you know, during Nirvana Unplugged as well, you know, which is just a completely iconic, amazing, once-in-a-lifetime performance, you know, where they, you know, they stripped all the songs back to acoustic and they were still just as beautiful and as meaningful as ever, you know, even without all the distortion and fuzzy guitars and thumping drums. You know, not saying that Dave Grohl's not a great drummer, because he is. He's amazing, you know, but I think that when you strip the songs back just to the bare bones, you know, it really shows, you know, how great a songwriter that Kurt Cobain really was.
So now seems a good time as any just to go track by track. So our opening track is Blue. Comes straight out the gates with that kind of grungy sound that Sub Pop were renowned for at the time. How does Blue open the album for you? Is it a good statement of intent for kind of what people would expect from the album?
I just think that it just starts, that bass line is just really raw and dirty, you know? So I just think that it hooks you in straight away, you know, and then when the drums hit, the song's got a really cool groove to it, you know, that even though it sounds really angry, you know, it makes you want to punch stuff, it also kind of makes you want to dance as well, you know? So yeah, I don't know about statement of intent or anything. You know, I think that people can actually look too much into records, you know, that sometimes there isn't actually really much planning, you know, or anything behind it. It's just a bunch of people just playing music just for the sake of it, you know, and it's funny because people always try and overanalyze it, but sometimes it really is what it is and it's just say what you see, you know.
From album to albums, you know, there's some albums that we've talked about where it really is, they've been really meticulous about kind of the running order or this, that and the other. And then there's other albums like this one where they've just got in a room and recorded it and this is the finished product. Kurt once said that Blue was about his struggling with growing up in Aberdeen. NME quote him as having fantasies about killing his classmates with the rather chilling quote, "I fantasized about it, but I would have always opted to kill myself first." Do you get that kind of sense of restlessness and claustrophobia that he felt in a song like Blue?
I do remember Kurt Cobain saying something about how people always read far too much into his lyrics and, you know, and how they would take it seriously when really he was just talking a lot of shit or, you know, or he was just messing around, you know, messing with people's heads and things like that. So, you know, I think that one sentiment that does carry across, you know, the whole of the album and every single Nirvana record and show ever is that he said, you know, it doesn't matter if it's sloppy, you know, as long as it's got passion, then that's all that matters. So
Blue's one of the few tracks of the Bleach era that remained a part of their set list like throughout their live history. what is it about the song that helped it kind of stand up throughout their career as they released their other albums? What was it about Blue that helped it kind of stand up?
I don't necessarily know if it was Blue or not. I think it was probably About a Girl or Love Buzz that were the key tracks on the album, you know, that people wanted to play on the radio because they were more pop and more radio friendly, you know. And every Nirvana Live concert I ever watched on YouTube, I never really heard Blue, to be honest. It was usually always About a Girl or Love Buzz, you know, as they seem to be the fan favourites and, you know, the most fun songs that the band liked to play.
So our next track is Floyd the Barber. Kurt claims that he wrote the majority of the lyrics the night before, as he did with many of them. And I feel like Floyd the Barber gives us a really fascinating insight into the mind of Kurt Cobain, because the song is actually about characters from a 60s TV show, The Andy Griffith Show, but a distorted version in which Floyd holds him captive and murders him. So it's this kind of disturbing yet kind of fascinating insight into his mind. But then I'm thinking about what you just said before, that maybe people think too much into those lyrics and maybe he was just kind of having a bit of a laugh with it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, any song means so many different things to so many different people. And, you know, and as an artist, people are constantly asking you to justify and give explanation for your work. In any Nirvana interview I ever read or heard, it always seems to be something that Kurt Cobain really despised doing, you know. If you want to take a really great quote, then, you know, look no further than Freddie Mercury. It was the same for him. People are always saying, you know, what does Bohemian Rhapsody really mean? And he said, well, you know, if you see it, then it's there, darling. So, you know, if you see it, then it's probably there. Who's to say what's right and wrong? And, you know, in a song, if you feel something, then it's real to you. And that's the beauty of songwriting and art, you know, is that, you know, a lot of the time it doesn't make any sense. And rock and roll, you know, 1 + 1 = 3, like that's what Bruce Springsteen says. So it's why, you know, Nirvana don't make sense, Queen don't make sense, Louie doesn't make any sense, I don't make any sense most of the time. You know, we're all just weird and living in a vibe.
And I think what's interesting when you're talking about kind of people, like Freddie's quote makes so much sense, that kind of if that's what you read into it, then it's there. To the point that until Kurt Cobain's handwritten lyrics were released a few years later, many people were adamant that the first line of the song was "Hello, Cobain, come on in," which would kind of again add to the whole kind of subplot of this song that kind of people had built up, that this what the song was about and what must he be thinking as he's watching this TV show. But then maybe those, you know, once the lyric sheets came out, that wasn't even the first line of the song at all.
Yes, exactly. It's like when little kids sing along to when they sing along to their favourite song, and it, you know, and they've got no idea what it is, but you know the syllables and the kind of sounds that it makes. It's quite funny, really. I've had some other things with my songs as well where people have just totally got the lyrics wrong, and I'm like, and it's kind of a bit strange, but you know, it's all part of the fun, isn't it? Of, you know, discovering music and, you know, and getting to know the band and the lyrics inside out, I suppose.
So that's Louise Distress there talking with me about her classic album Bleach by Nirvana. I'm going to be getting back to that conversation in just a minute. We're going to continue to go through the album track by track. Coming up, why was About a Girl considered something of a risk? And does Negative Creep have a thrash metal influence? All that and more right after this. Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1. With guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight, I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird, I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. and on Podnos, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. So we'll move on to About a Girl, which was written by Cobain in 1988 after spending an afternoon listening to Meet the Beatles.
Yeah, I, it's funny because like when the first time I even heard that song, and obviously, you know, because you know, the Beatles are just one of those classic bands, they soundtrack everybody's life. So I even when I was 13 and knew nothing about music, I listened to About a Girl and I was like, this sounds exactly like the Beatles. and I think that Kurt probably just wanted to be Paul McCartney and John Lennon, really, you know. I mean, you know, what songwriter wouldn't want to be like the Beatles? You know, they've written the greatest songs of all time ever, period.
I mean, producer Butch Vig, who would go on to produce Nevermind, he highlights About a Girl as an important song in Kurt's development as a songwriter. So he told Enemy, everyone talks about Kurt's love affair with the punk scene, but he was also a huge Beatles fan. And the more time we spent together, the more obvious their influence on his songwriting became. Do you think that helped him kind of stand out amongst the other grunge bands that were around at the time? Do you think, I mean, I know you said About a Girl's particularly Beatles-y. Do you think that kind of continued to bleed through as time went on?
I think every single songwriter looks up to and absolutely idolises the Beatles. Like I said, they wrote some of the greatest songs of all time. So I think it's something that's bigger than grunge. It's even bigger than rock and roll. It's bigger than country, bigger than hip hop. You know, it's the Beatles are just like, they're like the start of music, you know, like except for like Elvis, of course. But it's like, you know, the Beatles are like, and the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Elvis, you know, that's like for a lot of people, you know, where rock and roll actually begins. So I just think, you know, any songwriter looks up to the Beatles and that's really all there is to it.
I know that Kurt was worried that a poppier song like About a Girl would kind of alienate the grunge fan base that Sub Pop were working so hard to kind of attract. He told Rolling Stone in 1993, to put About a Girl on Bleach was a risk. I was heavily into pop. I really liked REM and I was into all kinds of 60s stuff. But there was a lot of pressure within that social scene, the underground, like that kind of thing you get in high school. And to put a jangly REM type of pop song on a grunge record in that scene was risky. And again, it must be really difficult to juggle kind of what your fans or your record label expects of you and being able to stretch out and do what you want to do and produce the album that you want to produce.
I never heard about Kurt Cobain saying that. I think anybody who's actually an artist would not really pay any mind to what the market wants or what the fans want. Every single songwriter that I ever met or looked up to always just wrote for themselves without other people in mind, because it's usually the case that when you actually start writing for other people and you actually start writing for the record label, that's when your music and your art is just, it becomes content and not songwriting or art at that point. So it just seems like writing for the people is just a futile, pointless exercise because it doesn't work. I mean, one thing that I found from when I discovered Nirvana through Kurt Cobain, I actually discovered a lot of other bands as well. You know, he was really, really great at turning people on to other bands, you know, such as, you know, like Butthole Surfers, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains, you know, Black Flag, etc. I just think any songwriter just wouldn't write for anybody other than themselves. It just doesn't make any sense. Seems so ridiculous.
So both Enemy and Q Magazine have named About a Girl the second best Nirvana song ever in these separate polls. What is it about a Girl that makes it such a well-loved and important song for Nirvana?
I just think it's because it's no different to any other song that becomes really popular. And, you know, the reason why people like it is because it's got great heartfelt lyrics. It's honest and you can sing along to it. I think that's all it takes to write a good song, really. Like Kurt Cobain said, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a bit shit and sloppy, you know, as long as it's got passion. And that's it. That's all there is to it.
So we'll move on to School. School is essentially a comparison by Cobain between the clicky nature of the Washington grunge scene and the clicky nature of high school. And the working title of the song was The Seattle Scene. I've got a quote here, someone kind of reviewing the song. No story is told, no indictment read. The meaning is made clear through the singer's repeated cries of no recess. It's the angry but unsurprised yell of someone who's been ripped off, but who expects no less from the powers that be. Do you think kind of the repetitive lyrics and the delivery of that Does it make School one of the angrier songs on the album? You've said that Bleach is a pretty angry album as it goes.
Yeah, I just think that a song like School, you know, it's just a straight up angry punk rock song, really, written in response to, you know, the 1+1=2 equation, which is a repetitive soul sucking grind that a lot of people go through every day. You know, it goes back to, you know, my opening statement about the album, and that, you know, it sounds like it was written and sung by people that have been signed off to the scrap heap of life. So I think that School is probably, you know, it's definitely a key moment on the album, you know, and all the feelings and themes that it encompasses.
So, I mean, we've said that the song's somewhat aimed at the Seattle grunge scene. It's also said been somewhat aimed at Sub Pop. And you kind of touched on near the start that he had this kind of relationship with the record label where there was kind of pressure from them for the type of album that they wanted. He said there was this pressure from Sub Pop and the grunge scene to play rock music, but he notes that he stripped it down and made it sound like Aerosmith. I mean, and School's a really good example of it. It's just Kurt taking the songs and just making them, you know, what he wants them to be, rather than kind of conforming, as we've been discussing there, to kind of what the record company wants or what anybody wants.
Yeah, I mean, you know, none of us, you know, we can try and analyse Kurt Cobain's mindset and his lyrics, you know, and his songs all we want, but, you know, one thing we can't do is put ourselves in his shoes. You know, we can only put ourselves in our own shoes, you know, and what the songs mean to us, you know. So for me, like I said, as a 13-year-old, 12-year-old girl that was bullied at home and bullied at school, and feeling like it was relentless and like I never got a break and that there was no escape for it, you know, a song like School really, really spoke to me, especially when he's repeating and screaming at the top of his lungs, you know, no recess, no recess, because that's what it feels like. It feels like you're just met constantly with this, like, wall of hostility and aggression, you know, and being told that there's something wrong with you and you don't know why. You know, so you end up feeling, you know, outcasted and alienated. But then when you hear songs like that, even if, you know, it makes you feel a lot less alone, you know, and that's something that's very empowering for everybody, and that's why music, you know, changed my life, and it changed all of our lives together, and I'm sure as it changed Kurt Cobain's life, you know, when he was a teenager and he was getting bullied at school as well, you know, and he was having problems at home, you know, and he went, so, you know, he discovered, you know, those Beatles records, you know, those Black Flag records, those Sex Pistols records. It's like the circle of life, but in music, you know.
Yeah, so we'll move on to Love Buzz. So Love Buzz was initially released as a single before the initial album sessions. It's the song that led Nirvana setting to work on a full album. So the original version was recorded by Dutch rock band Shocking Blue for their 1969 album At Home. So again, it's those 60s influences at play that we were talking about earlier. Have you heard the Shocking Blue version?
Yeah, I've heard it years ago, but I can't remember it, to be honest. And I think it's quite often the case, you know, when a band covers a song, you know, it brings new life into it, and it's quite often the case that the cover version gets more credit than the original. You know, that it's happened a lot over the course of music history. So
yeah, I mean, I had a bit of a listen to it while I was kind of getting stuff ready for our chat, and the original version does have a cool bass line, but I think what's really cool about the Nirvana version is the bass. It's absolutely awesome, and Nirvana's version seems a bit more fast-paced, and it seems like it's more updated for a modern audience. So Robbie Van Leeuwen, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, who's the man behind the Shocking Blue version, first heard Nirvana's version in a record shop, but claims not to have bought it because it was inferior. So so there you go. I guess, you know, if he's behind that, he can make that decision, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that would probably not agree with him.
Well, you know, it's always a compliment when somebody likes what you do, so... Like, just take the damn compliment, you know.
Yeah.
It's not really that much of an insult, you know.
No, not at all. And yet on the original UK pressings of Bleach, Love Buzz was substituted for a song called Big Cheese, which was the B-side of the original Love Buzz single. Have you heard Big Cheese? And do you think that Bleach without Love Buzz would be strange? Like, does it seem odd to not have that song on the album?
Well, for every album, there needs to be a song that can go on the radio, so they probably just recorded it so it could go on the radio. I don't really think there's much rocket science behind the choice to record it. You know, they were probably just really, really big fans of the song and just wanted to, you know, sort of pay homage, as, you know, as a lot of bands do.
So, I mean, for so many people who bought that initial single, that was potentially their first exposure to Nirvana. And I don't know if it was on the mixtape that you got. Was it one of the first songs that you heard as well, or was that when you kind of seeked the album out?
I can't really remember, to be honest. I just remember that it was actually Paper Cuts, which was the one that got me. That was the one that sucked me in.
Well, it seems like a good time to go on to Paper Cuts, because that's next. In his 2004 biography, Kurt Cobain, Christopher Sanford describes Paper Cuts as a folk-influenced melody and ponderous rhythm of an early Led Zeppelin number. You'd said that you kind of heard the Beatles comparisons in About a Girl. Do you hear kind of a Led Zeppelin comparison in Paper Cuts?
Well, Kurt was a big Led Zeppelin fan, and he even had a song called Aero Zeppelin on Incesticide, right? So I think that one's a no-brainer.
And I know you'd said, am I right in thinking you said earlier that was the first song you learned to play on guitar?
Yeah, that's right, because it sounds really doomy and like it's out of tune, so even before you learn how to even tune a guitar, you can figure out how to play Paper Cuts. And, you know, when you're 13 and you don't know anything about playing a guitar, it kind of all sounds the same, as long as it just sounds like, you know, really mean and satanic. It's all good when you're 13.
So lyrically, this one is said to be about a family back in Aberdeen who apparently tortured their children and kept them locked in the attic. But it's funny, because whenever I read these now, I just think about what you were saying earlier about, like, don't take the lyrics too seriously. But it's been said, however, that it also touches on Cobain's own relationship with his mother. Do you find, kind of in your own songwriting, is it difficult to write about difficult relationships and aspects of life? Or is there kind of a sense of catharsis from writing a song like that where you think, right, yeah, I feel so much better that I've got that out?
No, I think that for some reason I find it a lot easier to bear my soul through writing songs and performing them on stage. It's actually burying my soul in real life that I have a problem with. I've got no idea why that is. But I think for a lot of people, to be able to be vulnerable and bear your soul, you know, and talk about your fears and your hopes and your dreams and your loves, you know, and even to just simply be yourself, it's actually just one of the hardest things that there is in life. But through music, we're able to, you know, suck in these feelings from these songs, be able to express them through our own creativity and our own expression through whatever medium. And I just think that that's the great thing about art, you know, is that we actually have expression.
So we'll move on to Negative Creep. So this is actually one of my favourite tracks on the album. My go-to music is kind of like hard rock and metal. And a lot of reviewers, including Pitchfork, have likened the sound on Negative Creep to thrash metal, which might go some way to explain why I enjoy it. Do you kind of agree with that idea that there's like a thrash influence in there? People talk about nods to Mudhoney in there as well.
I think it's all a load of shit, to be honest. I think he actually mixed it off. I was listening to a song the other day, and I think it was a Doug Sam of the Douglas Quintet. I can't remember the name of the song. I should have actually done my research and found out what it was called. But there's actually a section in this particular song that I can't remember the name of. And I was like, right, that is exactly where Kurt Cobain nicked that riff from. I don't think it's got anything to do with thrash metal. Probably robbed it off Doug Sam or like the Eagles or something like that.
Fair enough.
You know, it's usually the less obvious ones.
So Kurt's often said that the song is about him and that he is the negative creep. And he sings with such ferocity throughout. Mark Richardson of Pitchfork says, and I love this quote, he says, Cobain's voice throughout the second verse terrifies me. There is no concern for his physical well-being or even his future as a vocalist in a rock band. He sings as intensely as he can possibly sing. Sometimes, when I'm listening loud, I think my headphones might be breaking up from the volume, only to realise that the membrane being excited to the point of distortion is actually Cobain's larynx. So in an album full of kind of anger and intensity, is this the peak? I know we talked about school as well. Is this kind of as intense as it gets? Is this as angry as it gets?
Sometimes you don't have to be loud and scream and shout to be intense. Sometimes silence is more powerful. But one thing I will say is if you're not giving yourself a brain or an aneurysm, then you're probably not doing it right.
Fair enough. So in reviewing the album, Pop Matters throws some criticism in Negative Creep's way, citing repetitiveness as an issue. It says repetitiveness is a recurring problem on Bleach, namely in School and Negative Creep, the latter of which would be a far stronger track if the verse and chorus sections didn't go on forever. I'm guessing from the way you've talked about both those tracks, you don't think that they're weaker tracks on the album. I mean, you'd said that School was a pivotal point in the album, if I remember rightly, yeah?
I just think that it's really hypocritical of the music press to say that something's repetitive, because they all say the same things about every single band, and they build every band up and then they knock them down in the same exact way. And, you know, the thing is that the people who actually are the critics are the same people that actually know nothing about songwriting. They've usually never picked up a guitar in their life or written a song. So it's like, who are they to say, you know, what's repetitive or what's good and what's bad, you know. It's just all a load of hypocritical bullshit, really, to be honest.
So we'll move on to Scoff. So much is said about Kirk's relationship with his parents, who apparently disapproved of his decision to pursue a career in music, and Scoff is said to address this. So returning to that quote from earlier when he was talking about lyrics, he said, "Let's just scream negative lyrics, and as long as they're not sexist and don't get too embarrassing, it'll be okay." Yeah. I feel like that even if he was just writing lyrics for the sake of writing them, that forms kind of like a really confessional and raw album. So it's, they may have been throwaway, but obviously they mean a lot to you. And at the same time, there's something about that kind of stream of consciousness that, you know, maybe makes a more honest album, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, I think that comment that he said, like, it just sounds really tongue-in-cheek and sarcastic to me. I think it's hilarious.
So NME say about Scoff, this song's said to be about Kurt's relationship with his parents, as we've covered, who didn't think he should be pursuing music. This appears to be a myth. As Cobain came from a big musical family. His uncle Chuck Fredenberg starred in a band called the Beachcombers. His aunt Maury Earle played guitar, and his great-uncle Delbert had a career as a tenor. Do we know much about his family's musical background? It's not something I've really heard about before until I'd read that.
Oh, I got no idea. I wasn't really there at the time. I don't even think I was even born, to be honest. So I've got absolutely no idea, unless I was like originally a bug on the wall and then reincarnated as Louise Distraff. I haven't really got a clue. I'm pretty sure that his aunt was a big influence on him when he was growing up. I think maybe she bought him his first guitar. I saw some stuff on the Nick Broomfield documentary where she used to record him as a little kid, you know, learning how to play the guitar and when he was writing his first songs in the living room and things like that. Yeah, those recordings were really sweet and, you know, and really endearing. And, you know, the way that she spoke about her nephew and his love for music and how she wanted to encourage it. I think that, you know, that was really beautiful to hear. But other than that, I don't really know. I mean, I think it's usually quite often the case that for a lot of musicians, that their parents or their family aren't very supportive, you know, and they want them to get a real job and live in the real world and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, but for people like Kurt and, you know, and for myself and pretty much every other musician that I know, I think that feeling of, you know, kicking back against that, you know, and living 1+1=3 and not 1+1=2, it's actually a huge driving force, you know, in the quest for creativity and art and freedom and expression, you know, and the ability to just be yourself on your own terms, really.
So we're getting towards the end of the album now with Swap Meet. NME called Swap Meet one of Cobain's most bittersweet moments as a lyricist, as it was reportedly inspired by a couple he spotted rowing over bric-a-brac at a flea market in Aberdeen. Again, I guess with Kurt Cobain being such a big influence of yours, in your own songwriting, how much is inspired by kind of observations of life happening around you in the same way that Swap Meet was? Do you find that kind of people watching and watching the world go by, does that help you creatively?
I just think with any songwriter or any artist expressing through, you know, whichever medium they choose, you know, all we're doing is just saying what we see and the things that we hear and the things that we feel, and and we're just holding up a mirror to what goes on around us. We're all just products of our environment at the end of the day, and an artist are just people, you know, not aliens. And I think that's all there is to it. It's not really rocket science. But Kurt Cobain did, you know, has influenced, well, not influenced, but inspired my songwriting in a lot of ways, you know, first and foremost, you know, because if I never heard Bleach, I would have never even picked up a guitar. And when I was actually, you know, writing the first album, Dreams from a Factory Floor, you know, I actually wrote a song about Kurt on there. You know, the song's called No Mercy. So it was nice to be able to actually pay respect to an artist whose music changed my life, you know, through my own music. It was a nice thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So next is Mr. Mustache. This one seems to explore masculinity and what it means to be a man. So Nirvana biographer Charles R. Cross said the title of the song was influenced by the jocks at Cobain's high school that grew thick mustaches in order to try and identify with this kind of concept of masculinity. Today, in 2019, that traditional idea of masculinity is a bit of a problematic one. But it was certainly considered very normal in the 80s. Do you think that Kurt Cobain and his rejection of this masculinity was very forward-thinking for the time?
Well, I think that punk rock in general, you know, and bands like The Slits, for example, and, you know, Kurt being surrounded by people like Toby Vail and Kathleen Hanna and, you know, feminist ideas, and also, you know, the fact that he, you know, he was bullied and, you know, and the other kids called him gay at school and things like that, I think that that definitely shaped him. Anything, any experience like that, you know, it's going to shape the way that you look at the world and identify the prisons that we put each other in and the prisons that society puts us in. And I think that, you know, one great thing about Kurt is that he did put those messages across all the time. You know, he was always very, very pro-women, you know, pro-LGBT, you know, and I think he even wrote in one of the liner notes, I think it was in Incest Society, he said, you know, look, you know, if you hate gay people, if you hate people of colour, and if you hate women, then please do not buy my records and come to my shows. And I think that was probably one of the biggest statements he could have made, you know, at the peak in his career. And it's something that affected a lot of people and empowered a lot of young people as well, you know, to hear, as much as he didn't like the fact that people put him on a pedestal, you know, he recognised that there was power that comes with that and he used it for the better. So, you know, as a young teenager, to hear your idol saying that, that's a very life-changing moment and a very empowering moment for many young people, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a quote from Kurt here. He says, in a community that stresses macho male sexual stories is a highlight of all conversation, I was an underdeveloped, immature little dude that never got laid and was constantly razzed. Oh, poor little kid, it bothered me. And I feel like with a song like Mr. Mustache, he becomes this almost a voice for that kid in school that wasn't developed enough. And suddenly, you know, you're saying, as a teenager, that's a really life-changing message. Someone singing songs from that perspective and they're saying, like, this is shit. We shouldn't have to go through this. We shouldn't have to deal with this. And there's someone there, a voice, finally, for all those people. And I guess, like you said, it would be life-changing for so many people. And it sounds like it was life-changing for you too.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that, you know, as an artist, when you are actually just, you know, you're just expressing yourself and you're writing these songs, you don't ever have it in mind like, oh, I'm going to be a voice for people or I'm going to be the voice of a generation. Like I said, it just comes from saying what you see, what you hear, what you think and feel, you know, and holding that mirror up and just expressing yourself. But if it's something that a lot of people can connect with, then I guess that's why people end up, you know, like such as Music Press, end up making these stupid statements, you know, such as voice of a generation, you know, I think he was a very reluctant voice of a generation, you know, in the same way that Bob Dylan was, you know, he never set out to be anything like that. But yet people continue to, you know, project their angles and their agendas onto them, you know, for whatever reason, usually as a way of censoring, I find from experience. But anyway, I digress.
So we'll move on to our final track on the album, which is Sifting. So it's the longest track on the album. Kurt was very guarded as to what the song was about, and he rarely spoke about it. Is it another case of kind of when we talk about Freddie Mercury earlier, kind of saying, if you see it, it's there? Do you have any thoughts about what Sifting's about, or are you happy just for that to be Sifting is what it is?
I mean, like I said, you know, as a 13-year-old discovering music for the first time, it was always just about the feeling that, you know, that those songs gave me. So sometimes, you can hear a song and it can be very immediate to you and to your consciousness of what that song actually means. But then sometimes you can listen to it and you don't really know what it means, but you just enjoy it because of the feeling that it gives you. You know, and then you go back later on and you actually find out, oh, actually, this is about whatever. You know, I just think that as a whole, like, people are, rather than the music press, can try and analyse these things to death so much that you can suck the life out of it, you know, but really it doesn't really mean anything, you know, it's just grave digging, it doesn't mean anything. What does mean something is the feeling that it gives to the kids, you know, and the impact that it has on them and how it changes their lives. And it's just all about feeling. That's it.
So, I mean, I know obviously there's a couple of bonus tracks on there. I'm guessing for you, that's how the album ends for you. So for you, Sifting isn't really the end of the album. I'm guessing that you would go to those bonus tracks as well.
No, like, I mean, Down is one of my favourite Nirvana songs of all time. I love it. It's completely punk rock. It's completely nihilistic. It's completely anti-authority. It's just brilliant. It's just everything you want to hear as a 13-year-old, you know, and it's something that you can jump around and pogo to and headbang and get a bang over from, you know. It's just absolutely brilliant. So I think that Down is just one of those, like, really underrated Nirvana songs that often gets overlooked, I guess maybe because it was, like, a bonus track or, you know, maybe a hidden track or something like that. But it's absolutely brilliant. It's probably, like, that is probably the highlight of the album for me, for sure.
And I guess that's really interesting, because obviously with it being a bonus track, it's not one that I thought that we would kind of visit. But for you, that's a really important part of the album, and for you, that's a really important song.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. And, you know, it's got swearing in as well. So, you know, as a 13-year-old, anything that's got curse words in, it's like, it's just like the ultimate rebellion for your parents, you know, when you can crank it up in your room and the song says, like, fuck, shit, piss. You know, it's brilliant.
So just to kind of to wrap things up, with Bleach, we're catching a legendary band in like a true moment in time just before they have this huge breakthrough. So while talking about the reissue of Bleach back in 2009, Pitchfork said original producer Jack Endino's new remastering job gives Bleach a much needed boost in fidelity, but there's an intrinsic primordial murkiness to this album that can't be polished. While Axl Rose was welcoming the masses into the Sunset Strip jungle, Nirvana dragged the sub-pop set into the bleak, chilly backwoods from which they came. Why do you think that Bleach stands the test of time for you and for everyone in general?
Just like how any other classic album stands the test of time, it's because the songs are honest, they're written from the heart, and you can sing along to them, and they're usually singing about, you know, things that will always happen, that always did happen, and will always last forever. So that, for me, is what makes an album a timeless classic.
And finally, why is Bleach your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Because it was the album that changed my life. Like I said many times, I was somebody who was bullied at home, bullied at school. I ran away from home as a teenager. I was very weird. I was a complete mosher. I was very outcasted, alienated, very isolated, you know. And hearing Bleach and hearing how primal and angry and, you know, and sparse it is, it's basically what my feelings as a teenager sounded like in the form of a CD, you know, and in form of music. So... yeah, so without the album, I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't have started playing guitar. It would not have turned me on to punk rock or the idea of the freedom to be yourself and express yourself on your own terms. And I think that anybody who likes music or likes guitar music or punk rock music or just any music, I think that it's just one of those albums that you should listen to.
Yeah, well, Louise, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun to kind of chat about the album and to have you on to talk about it.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. You know, usually people just ask me what my favourite colour is or what it's like to be a woman in rock. So it was actually really nice to be able to go into so much depth and actually just talk about the album that changed my life. It was a real treat and a pleasure. So, you know, thanks for having me on your show. It's been nice.
So a huge thanks to Louise de Strasse for taking time out of what's going to be a very busy year for her to sit down with me and chat about Bleach, the debut album by Nirvana, and indeed her classic album. And, you know, listen to that conversation, you can hear just how important that album and indeed Nirvana are to her. So she's just come off the back of a UK tour that is supporting her latest EP, Street Revolution, which is doing really well. It's getting all sorts of great reviews all over the place. Kerrang have said of Louise de Strasse, "Louise de Strasse has the kind of voice that could charm the paint from a car." So if that doesn't make your mind up, nothing will. So as I say, she's just come off the back of her own tour, but she will be supporting the Men That Will Be Blamed for Nothing on their UK tour throughout April, supporting that Street Revolution EP, which you can get on CD, download or streaming, and that is out now. You may have noticed during my chat with Louise that she touched a little bit on her experiences of being homeless as a teenager, and Louise has teamed up with Musicians Against Homelessness throughout her Street Revolution tour, and I'm sure beyond, to raise awareness about homelessness and to raise money for the charity Crisis. So if you want to know more about that, get yourself to www.musiciansagainsthomelessness.net, or indeed, if you want to find out more about the charity, get yourself to www.crisis.org.uk. And so brings us to the end of another episode of My Classic Album. Thanks very much for joining me, and thanks very much to Louise for joining us and discussing Bleach. It's been cool. Coming up next time on My Classic Album, we've got an old friend returning. So anyone who listened to our 30 Years of Hysteria episode back in 2017 will remember Rob Wild. He's the lead singer of Tiger Tales and Midnight City. And we always said after that we would definitely have to revisit this again and do another album. So Rob is back, and he brings with him Crazy Nights by Kiss, which was actually released only a month after Hysteria by Def Leppard. So I guess for him, in a lot of ways, those two albums go hand in hand. and no doubt we'll be chatting about that. It actually makes Kiss the first artists in my classic album history to have two episodes dedicated to two of their albums. And I'm sure there'll be many more examples where that happens, but this is kind of the first. So that's pretty cool. If you've got any thoughts on that, if you've got any thoughts on Bleach, if you've got any thoughts on anything, by all means, get yourself to our social media pages and have your say. Until next time, I'm Mike Norris, and thank you for listening to My Classic Album.